Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the 49th edition of Data Bytes, Getting Things Done with Data in Government, kindly supported by Naus Group. I'm Gavin Freegard, Associate at the Institute for Government, and it's wonderful to welcome so many of you this evening here at the IFG and online. Let's start in the usual way. Hands up if you've been to Data Bytes before. Welcome back. Hands up if this is your first Data Bytes. Welcome. A particular welcome to whichever one of you when signing up for tonight's event and asked if you had any access requirements, put emergency exits when Gavin makes jokes. You're going to regret that. We have four brilliant speakers on data for you tonight that will richly reward your close attention and detailed analysis like it was a photo from Kensington Palace. Unlike that, though, we'll be keeping it real tonight. And rest assured, tonight's event will live up to its billing a lot better than this month's other viral moment, Glasgow's rather wonky Willy Wonka experience. I'm sure there's a political analogy in there somewhere. Some housekeeping before we embark upon our voyage through a dreamland of data-related delights. Tonight's event is on the record and we are being live-streamed, obviously. If you'd like to get involved on social media, it's hashtag IFGDataBytes and we are live-tweeting, still, from at IFGEvents. If you're watching online, you can put questions to our speakers using the Slido page, or almost certainly already on. It's bit.ly/SlidoDB49, capital S, capital DB if you're not. If you're here at the IFG, you can use that or raise your hand. Why does the IFG organise Data Bytes? Well, we aim to bring together the various different data communities in and around government, show everyone what better data can achieve in practice, and put interesting data projects on the record so we can all learn from them. How does Data Bytes work? You're going to see four presentations about data this evening. Each presentation will last for 8 minutes. Yes, just 8 minutes. There are 8 bits in a byte, hence 8 minutes in a data byte. The presenter will then face questions for 8 minutes. Yes, just 8 minutes. And then we'll move on to the next presentation. So four presentations of 8 minutes, each followed by questions for 8 minutes. This is our 49th Data Bytes. You can watch the previous 48 events, that's 6 whole cycles of 8, on the IFG website. Now, we normally begin with a look back at the last few weeks in UK politics in charts. But around this time of year, I also tend to show off some charts highlighting Wales's achievements in the Six Nations. Because after all,
I am a Welshman.
So, here are some charts. Here are some charts showing off Wales's achievements in this year's Six Nations. No wins. Bottom of the table. Obviously, just a bad year while we build for the future. Next year will be much better.
You're a fantasist!
Probably. Those clips are from Nye at the National Theatre. Nonetheless, it's been a big few weeks for Wales and politics. While most people watching the budget were focused on fiscal rules, tax cuts and public services, plenty of analysis on the IFG website, in time-honoured Data Bytes tradition, I was paying attention to how the Chancellor pronounced Welsh place names.
We will help fund the renovation of Theatre Clwyd.
Now, Clwyd is an accepted anglicised version, but it should really be Cloyd. Repeat after me, Cloyd. Very good.
To purchase the Wilfer site in Ynysmon.
The Welsh name for Anglesey, not Ynysmon. We've done this one before at Data Bytes. Say after me, Ynys. Morn. Ynys Morn. Very good. And of course, Anglesey is where you will find Clan Fight Bull Quingil Cogedi Quindrobal Clan Tasilio Gorgor Gorch. Anyone? One day somebody's going to do that from the audience. Now, the Welsh Labour leadership concluded this weekend where Vaughan Gething beat Jeremy Miles. Good. Now, the First Minister has only ever changed through internal Labour elections, never at a Senedd election. Gething beat Miles by inches, the cursed ratio of 52 to 48. Recriminations may not be on the scale of Brexit, but with controversies around campaign donations and union tactics, Gething may face similar team-building challenges to the Welsh Rugby Union. Moving now to Westminster, just after our last Data Bites, there was the Rochdale by-election, yet another seat changing hands. The story this time was a Labour loss rather than a government one. George Galloway won for his Workers' Party. Galloway there, looking like the cat who got the cream. Here are the results in Rochdale since 1979. You can see that collapse in the Labour vote on the right-hand side. I say Labour vote. It was a bizarre by-election where both Labour and the Greens disowned their candidate before polling day, where three of the candidates had previously been Labour, and where one of those, Simon Danchuk, had previously been the Labour MP, then stood as an independent before standing for Reform this time round. Galloway's victory means Rochdale is now the fifth different constituency he's represented. Whatever you think of his politics, you have to salute his indefatigability. Elsewhere in Westminster, we may get another by-election with a recall petition in Blackpool South. 6,000 signatures would be enough to trigger that. Former Tory Deputy Chair Lee Anderson's defection to Reform means 13 parties plus independents and the Speaker are now represented in the Commons, and we've had 52 changes of allegiance this Parliament. And our famous ministerial resignations chart remains unchanged for the moment, but Defence Minister James Heapey has announced his intention to stand down in the near future. Recently departed Tory Tech Minister Paul Scully gave us a political quote for the ages this month, noting the bell curve distribution of voters and hoping his party would focus on the middle of the bell and not become the ends. Also not appearing on the resignation chart, in a torrid few weeks for the governing party, Scully's old boss, DSIT Secretary Michelle Donnellan, was in hot water after using public money to settle a libel claim. Well, now, we have exclusive pictures from DSIT's legal department. The government suffered further defeats on the Rwanda bill. We have exclusive pictures from the bill team. And the racism row over Tory donor Frank Hester rumbled on. We have exclusive pictures from Conservative campaign headquarters. The Prime Minister also announced there would not be a general election at the same time as the local elections in early May. That came shortly after an Ipsos poll showing the Tories at their lowest ever vote share. Keep an eye on the right-hand side. Here it is, down to just 20%. Now, if you're worried that the British government is broken, never fear, a new IFG report is here, following a major commission on how to reform the centre of government. We had former PMs Major and Brown speaking at the launch. Now, you normally only see that many ex-PMs together at the cenotaph. This is from last autumn. One Twitter user decided to scale them to the lengths of their premierships. Liz Truss is there. Honest. Now, at 8 minutes each, almost as long as Truss's premiership, but making a much more positive lasting impression, are tonight's speakers. First, we'll hear from Viv Adams of the Information Commissioner's Office on the data sharing code and sharing data for safeguarding children and young people. Second up will be Peter Horn from Naus on leveraging data to drive efficiencies and improvements in operations. Third, we'll hear from Dominic Hale from the Office for National Statistics on the Integrated Data Service. And our fourth and final speaker will be Steve Whittler of Visual Meaning on creating shared meaning at national highways. Next up for Data Bites is the Big 5-0, Data Bites 50, 5 whole years of the series, provisionally in the diary for the 17th of April, but it will almost certainly move, so make sure you sign up for the IFG events newsletter and keep an eye on the IFG website. A huge thank you to Naus Group for supporting tonight's event. We are only able to run Data Bites through the support of partners. If you would like to demonstrate similar Naus and sponsor an event, including our 50th, please drop Pritesh an email. And as ever, if you would like to follow in the footsteps of our speakers, please do get in touch with me. That's more than enough for me. Over to our first speaker, and that's Viv.
Hi, good evening. Oh, right, which one is it? Is it that one? Oh, have I turned it off? Have I broken your slides already? It didn't appear. I have broken it.
Oh, no, I think we are back. I think this is the first time we've ever done this.
Aha.
Hooray.
Which one shall I press? That right one. Yes. Okay, well, here we are. Right. This is what I'm going to talk about. I just want to introduce myself briefly. Yes, I'm in the central government team at the Information Commissioner's Office, and with colleagues I worked on developing the statutory data sharing code and our recent 10 steps safeguarding guidance. So how often do we hear we can't share personal data, personal information, because of data protection? We hear that a lot. But to channel Barack Obama, I'm sorry, yes, you can, really can. It's mistaken to think that, or to claim that you can't share personal information because of data protection law. Our key message is that data protection doesn't prevent information sharing, in fact, it enables it. Today I'm going to talk you through what the ICO has been doing to dispel the myths that we hear across all sectors. We've been doing this by means of engagement, including at speaking engagements like this one, and our annual conference. We've produced new guidance, case studies, and the statutory code. Sharing with and by government is so significant that a lot of our work has been with government departments and other public bodies, including the ONS, who are represented here. Our work is aimed at clarifying that data protection law is an enabler for data sharing. It provides a framework in which you can share data fairly and proportionately, rather than being a barrier. So starting with the data sharing code itself, which became statutory in 2021 after a bit of a gestation through the pandemic, which, as I was talking earlier with some people, has become rather an excuse for everything. It wasn't an excuse. We were doing a lot of things, so it was developed during that time. After we did a call for views and a very popular formal consultation, and it provides practical guidance on data sharing, explains the law in what I hope is a readable way, and it has examples and case studies. And the emphasis is on what to do rather than what not to do. So, as I said earlier, it's an enabling approach. It's accompanied by a whole suite of resources to support organisations, which we keep growing. So we've got data sharing myths busted, we've got a checklist, we've got guidance on sharing by and with law enforcement bodies, such as police, but it isn't just the police who are law enforcement bodies, as you probably know, government departments are too. And a step-by-step toolkit to steer you through sharing data with law enforcement bodies. That was in response to the police saying to us that people were saying, well, we can't share that with you, data protection doesn't allow it, so we actually have a tool that you can walk through to do that. We've also produced guidance for universities about sharing information in an emergency to prevent mental or physical harm. And that came by a different route. We had a Prevention of Future Deaths report from Her Majesty's Coroner, and also we did some work with a group of bereaved parents whose young people had taken their own lives at universities. And we worked with Universities UK to produce guidance that makes clear that, yes, you can in an emergency, you shouldn't hesitate at all if it's to prevent harm, to share information. So we've got lots of case examples, case studies in the code and around it, like ones developed with Ofsted, the NHS, Office of National Statistics, and DLUHC, other Whitehall departments, and other government bodies. We're keen to add to these, so please let us know if you'd like to help with those. There'll be an email address at the end, near the end. We also support data sharing work by other government departments, such as the Department for Education on its Working Together, which is safeguarding guidance and other matters, and Cabinet Office on its emergency data sharing. This is a screenshot, not sure how much you can read, of part of our data sharing webpage You can find it on our website by just put data sharing and you'll find it. And there are more items as well, but that's just a selection. So you can see what it looks like. In 2021, when the code was published, Elizabeth Denham, our then commissioner, emphasised that data sharing that engenders trust in how personal data is being used is a driver for innovation, competition, economic growth, and giving a greater choice to consumers and citizens. This is especially true in the sphere of public service delivery, where efficient data sharing can improve insights and outcomes and improve public service, increase options for citizens. She did emphasise, though, that the ICO alone, our engagement and advice, cannot solve everything because there are some barriers to data sharing. Not data protection law, but cultural ones. We've always done it this way, for example. Or technical ones, organisational ones. IT systems in one organisation not speaking to another. We found that in relation to local authorities, for example. And overcoming all these, we'll need more than the ICO. We need collective effort from practitioners and government, other public sector organisations too. So we're continuing to work with others across sectors. And we're continuing to engage with a wide range of organisations. Recent area of focus has been on sharing information to safeguard children and young people under 18. Both Elizabeth Denham and John Edwards, our current commissioner, met with the House of Lords Public Affairs Committee about data sharing and the code, and we all agreed that the ICO would develop guidance to support child safeguarding. And after working with a range of organisations, including the DfE and various charities, in September last year, we published our new guidance, which is up there, the 10-step guide to sharing information. It's got simple steps in it to give confidence to anybody when sharing information to safeguard a child or young person at risk of harm. And it emphasises, as it says on screen, it can be more harmful not to share information that is needed to share to protect a child or young person. It doesn't tell you how to safeguard because that is not our remit, but it does give you practical advice on data protection as part of the safeguarding process. We're all aware of the many tragic cases where children have suffered harm or died through abuse or neglect. And case reviews do identify gaps in information sharing as one of the reasons, not always the main reason, but one of the reasons contributing to failures to protect children. So data protection law, we emphasise, has got an enabling role supporting you to share that information to prevent that harm. We've also produced a simple infographic. I'm afraid I haven't got it on screen, but it's on our website. To help staff who might not be expert in data protection, so you could put it up in a staff room. We've also produced marketing materials, including, Gavin, one in Welsh. Look, we've got more as well. We always try to translate stuff into Welsh for obvious reasons. With the strapline, think, check, share. I do hope that says think, check, share. yes, and we've got plans for more. So we've already done some initial work this year, in fact, with some organisations in particular geographical areas to spread the message locally, and we've got plans to do more. This is overarching guidance intended for all sectors, and we're also made clear that we're going to produce, and we've already started, individual sectoral guidance for each area, starting with education. We're going to do health, local authorities and so on to complement the 10 steps guidance. We've started work on this. If you'd like to be involved, please let us know. The email address is on the next slide. data sharing code, all one word lowercase, at ico.org.uk. To summarise, data protection law isn't a barrier. I'll be testing you afterwards. It provides a framework to do it fairly and proportionately. No one should be afraid to share information to safeguard a child or a young person. Our work continues across all sectors to spread these messages and produce guidance to support their work. Thank you.
Very much, Viv. For those of you joining us online, a reminder that you can use Slido that you should already be on to ask questions. It's bit.ly/SlidoDB49 if you're not already there. Anonymous has already asked, what is Welsh for data sharing, Gavin? Yes. So, if you're here in the audience, we will obviously take questions from you as well. You can use the Slido or you can wait for the mic to come around. Please do keep it short as we will get the clock started when you start asking the first question. Do just tell us who you are and where you're from if you can, but remember you are on the record. So let's go to the audience in the room first. Who would like to ask the first question?
Hi, it's Sam from Medical Confidential. Those people who think they can do whatever they want with data will do it irrespective of what the ICO guidance says. And those who are nervous are going to be nervous irrespective of what the ICO guidance says. So how do you help good people do good things without, you know, encouraging NHS England to do something stupid?
Well, that's a very difficult one. As I said, we're doing a lot of engagement, as much as we can. We have produced more simplified but clear guidance in the 10 steps and the infographic and the marketing materials to reach lots of levels of people. The dinner lady, the doctor's receptionist, they should know better, but people who may not know a lot, the groundsman, who may not know anything about data protection. So we're trying to reach all sorts of levels. We can't do it alone, as Elizabeth Denham made clear. I think there's always going to be people who are doing what they shouldn't do, but we will continue with our engagement, our public messaging, our data protection conference, and we will keep going. We are quite determined, but we're not a universal panacea.
Great, thank you. I'm going to go online for the first question. This is from Anonymous. Good evening to you as ever, Anonymous. When a project shares identifiable personal data while claiming it is anonymous, is that something in a legal grey area?
Unidentifiable, you mean? Sorry, can you just say that again?
So when a project shares identifiable personal data, but claiming it's anonymous, is that something in a legal grey area?
It's not exactly a grey area. It is difficult and requires judgment, and we've got quite a bit of guidance on it. My colleagues have been working, and I know they've actually done quite a bit of work with the ONS on it as well. It's not a area of my personal expertise in the code, and I rely very much on the advice of our colleagues. But a grey area, I wouldn't say a grey area exactly, but it can be technically difficult and requires some care.
Great, thank you. Let's come back into the room for the next question.
Hi, Viv.
Hello, what are you just going to ask me?
I was just curious, you mentioned a couple of things that are going to be coming down the line in the future. And I just wondered if you could say a wee bit more about that.
Sectoral guidance, yes. We wanted to produce an immediate overarching piece of guidance which any sector dealing with children could use. But we knew that different sectors have got particular needs. For example, there's different rules and guidance. For example, the statutory guidance the DfE has on working together. And also the NHS has particular requirements, and such as its common law duty of confidentiality and its own rules. So it's not possible for the overarching guidance to answer all those questions. So therefore, we
We have said we will produce separate pieces of guidance for each sector, and we have started engaging. We had already been engaging with them to write that guidance anyway, so we've got a bit of an idea, and we have started working with them. It will still be on data protection, not a guide to safeguarding, but it will be tailored to the sectors and also link out to their own guidance so that they can dip in, they see, oh, well, this is data protection, this is how this fits with our rules, as far as we can.
Great, thanks. I'll go online for the next question. Do you have concerns that people will be more reticent in giving their data if they can't trust it won't be shared without their express consent?
Well, consent in data protection terms is that's quite a difficult matter, because if you're talking about permission, in a common sense we would talk about permission, that's one thing, and you should always try and engage people. But consent is one of the lawful bases in data protection law, and it's not always in this particular sphere of safeguarding. I'm not talking about health, which is another kettle of fish, or can of worms, as it were, but in safeguarding, consent often is not appropriate. It's sometimes you can talk to people, say a family, and bring them along with you, but a consent is not the right lawful basis, quite usually, to use in data protection, in safeguarding. So if you want to safeguard a child, for example, you wouldn't necessarily get the parent's consent to share that information. So I can understand people being worried about it generally, but in a safeguarding context, it wouldn't be appropriate.
Fantastic, thank you. I should have said as well, that question came from somebody describing themselves as Dienor, which is the Welsh for anonymous, so thank you for that.
Oh, again, they got around this evening, haven't they?
I'm slightly scared of what I've started this evening. let's come back into the room for the next question. Oh, we've got two down at the front.
Oh, heavens. Speakers causing me pain, right.
Hi, sorry, I lean around the corner so you can see me. Dominic Hale from the Office for National Statistics. Just thinking about the kind of frameworks and things that you've put in place there for data sharing. One of the things that we are wrestling with, which I'll probably talk about when I do mine, is kind of everything's on a use case approach. Yes, we will share our data, but it's only for this use case, and where we want to get to is more of a sharing of data is the normal. So when the use case comes about, that data is already there to answer any kind of policy questions or interventions that need to be made. Is that the sort of thing that you're looking into? Kind of, is it specifically for use cases? Because you talked about DfE as an example earlier. Are you dealing with specific use cases, or are you thinking about broader?
Use cases are always a very useful tool to getting there. Yes, I mean, it's, and then you can turn them into examples for people, for the public or organisations to understand. So use cases are very helpful, and we have done quite a bit of work with DfE on those, so I agree, I think they're really important. Thank you.
Steve Whitler, Visual Meaning. One of the things I do outside of work voluntarily is I chair a governing body for a school.
I used to be a chair as well.
Sorry, I think lots of us have probably been there.
Probably.
And one of the constant frustrations is just the sheer barrage of information that comes out of central government, local government, lots and lots of organisations. The information you've shared tonight is so critical for people to hear, and I imagine it must be very frustrating for you communicating into such an information-rich environment. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts, if you could change how that environment works so that really critical messages get through, is there anything that you would do?
So that critical messages filter down to the schools?
Yeah.
Yes, well, we've got such a varying system of schools, haven't we? We've got academies, and we deal with the UK as well, and academies in Scotland are not the same as academies in England. In fact, they don't have ones like we do, and they don't have them in Wales either. And so we're very reliant on the DfE to spread the word down, and obviously they're very busy. So we're constantly thinking about that, about how we can disseminate the message. And in fact, when we're doing the sectoral guidance, we will be engaging with people like governors, head teachers, teachers, generally, so we will be aiming to do that. So hopefully that will spread the word even more, because it'll be much more extensive. But thank you.
Great, and we started the time a little bit earlier, so I'm going to squeeze in a final follow-on question from that. Anonymous, again, asks, Often it's important for children's safeguarding that individuals' records can be linked across various data sets, for example, healthcare with education data. Does the ICO have any guidance on the use of unique identifiers to allow data linking?
The unique identifier for children that has been proposed by the DfE and the Children's Commissioner, I assume.
I think it is.
Yes, I mean, there have been other proposals. I think there have been a couple of proposals by MPs as well, and one of the political parties is interested in it. There is has been a proposal by the DfE. They produced a report last year to Parliament about it. So it is something that is being considered at the moment, and I think there's quite a lot more to do before we've all firmed up our views on it.
Excellent. Well, we shall watch that space. Viv, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Our second speaker tonight is Peter. Over to you.
Good evening, everyone. Okay, Nice Group are obviously delighted to have the opportunity to support Databytes this evening. We're fans of doing things with data. In fact, as a management consultancy that's based over a number of countries, we're often frustrated by organisations that don't use data and don't form that foundation of data to make sensible choices. And when I thought about what we would cover this evening, I started off thinking, actually, I was going to talk about something that would be slightly kind of, I'm talking about data, it's not necessarily a massively exciting subject, but actually I got more and more frustrated about the context to it that I'll share over the time that we've got. So just to let you know, the examples that I'm going to be sharing this evening are based on a benchmarking program that NOUSE has been running for around about 15 years. It runs across about 500,000 employees across about 65 separate organizations within the higher education sector. So it's not within government departments or other public bodies, it is within universities. So I suppose what I'm going to cover in a nutshell is essentially we're in a world where organizations are facing fundamental challenging budget cuts. We see examples within the higher education sector of people actually doing data-led organizational change. And my frustration this evening that I'm going to be talking around is the fact that we don't yet see that being done within UK government departments and agencies to the extent that it could be. And I'll go into why that is. And then actually what we see that comes out of that is a whole series of sustainable savings that are possible. So in a world in which organizations face a lot of challenge, there are tools which are being completely underutilized by the UK public sector that we think should be taken up. Right, I could have put this slide up at any point since probably about 2008, maybe even 2007, if you were sitting in the Treasury. There has been 16 plus years of organizations looking and saying, we've got less and less money. We've got more and more challenge around what we're gonna do. It's not where I was. I can remember conversations with individuals in the Treasury in kind of 2003, 2004, which is, I'm only really bothered if it's a quarter of a billion in terms of additional NHS expenditure, and if it's lower than that, it's a rounding error. We're not in that situation now, and yet we behave as if we are. And in response to that, the concept that data might help is something that won't surprise either people online or people that are in this room. But when it comes to that challenge and question, as to how is it that the leaders of organizations respond to what they should be doing in terms of changes, in terms of actually when looking at the services they deliver and the choices that you have. All too often, you're in a world where people are looking at salami slicing. You're in a world where people are looking and stopping and saying, actually, we don't really know. We don't know. We don't necessarily know. And I'll say this, and this is from multiple years as both working in government and also as a consultant to government, we don't know who we employ. We don't actually know necessarily what their job titles are. We certainly don't know what they do with their time. And that is the reality for many organizations. And yet, I'm going to paint a different world, a world where you can do things that are different. So let me move on from the only meaning I'm going to display this evening. I was told by one of my colleagues not to attempt to be funny, because normally Databytes speakers are much funnier than I am. So thank you, Rosanna, for that. And then we'll move on. Actually, what do NOUSE do? We've developed a process, and we're not the only people who could be able to do this, but we've developed a process across roundabout, as I said before, 500,000 staff, where we're able to collect granular enough data to make sensible choices around strategic decisions in the organization. So this is being able to say, actually, if I'm thinking about a particular team in the organization, can I tell in buckets of around 10% of an individual's time what they're spending their time doing? Can I tell and can I curate information as to whether they're working at their level of seniority or whether they're working above what they're doing or below what they're doing? Can I tell whether or not people are specialists in role or whether people are asked to be doing things that are requiring multiple levels of skill? And actually, it's possible to collect that. And it's possible to collect that in a way that's actually pretty cost effective. And out of that, you get a whole series of data that tells you what you can do. What does that allow you to get into? And I'm conscious I put up here some graphs that are consciously detailed, because actually this is what we can see and what we can do. So if I can try and get this to work. Okay. I can't get the pointer to work, but as far as over here on the left, if you're looking at your organization, you can look in and you can say, actually, where am I in terms of cost? How do I compare to my peer group? And actually over here, you can see sort of this blue line here. You're kind of around about the middle of your peer group. But if you're actually in a situation which is I'm in the middle of my peer group, but I still need to cut costs, where should I start? What should I work on? Well, actually, there's other bits of data that come out of the system that allow you to engage in this. So the first bit of which is saying, well, actually, in my finance function, I know from what the data tells me that I overspend. And actually, what this comes to in here is the data is saying is compared to what your peer group are spending, you're spending 1.5 times as much. But actually, knowing that you spend 1.5 times as much in your finance function just takes you to the point of saying, well, cut your cost in your finance function. Actually, what you can do further around having collected the data in a sensible way is then split up that finance function. I don't know if you can see at the back, but these are little kind of scatter charts of pointing out, well, you're okay in one part of your finance function because you're saving an average, but in this one here and in that one there, you're way out of line. So actually, that's the question, which is, those are the areas that you should focus on. So in response to the challenge, get in there and focus on it. What are the other things that you can be doing? You can have clarity when you're looking at organizational change. So I've been part of too many organizational changes where it's not really clear what's in and what's out. Actually, by having structured data, you can start to say, well, these are the things that we're going to include. So if you're looking at centralizing certain things in an operating model, instead of having lots of confusion as to what's in and what's out, you can actually say, these are the things that are in, these are the things that are out. Alongside of that, you can be specific around, well, actually, of the things we've been considering as in scope, these bits we're going to do something with, and those bits we're going to keep away from. And then the final bit around here is, I don't wish to suggest there's too much gray hair in the room, but there'll be enough people in the room who've been a part of organizational change, where the organizational change has been announced in year one, and by about 18 months in, you've gone through the whole pain of the transition. And if you ask people in the organization, have we actually succeeded? People will come back and go, well, actually, we said we'd do this change, but to be honest, the cost just bounced back again. So you push down on the balloon, and as a consequence, actually, somehow or other, we managed to raise the cost of the organization rather than slim it down. If you're actually collecting data around what you do, you can tell whether or not you've succeeded. It's revolutionary. That's another example in here. The other thing that you can do in this is you can do data to demonstrate outcomes. So this is about saying an organizational change around specialization. And this is a real example. So in the left, it's saying, actually, what we're going to say is instead of expecting a fifth of our staff to be managers, lots of them being managers is a very small proportion of the role, and to be honest, they're not very good at it. You say, we're going to make being a manager a specialist role. So that's a bit around there of moving from a fifth of people being managers to about 1 in 10 people being managers. As a consequence, you then end up having your managers are much more focused in terms of what they do. So they spend 3/4 of their time being a manager as opposed to 40% of their time being a manager. What does that lead to in practice? You significantly reduce your cost because actually people who aren't very good at being managers spend more time as a manager. They're less effective. So collect the data and see what you can do with it. So I suppose I started off with a kind of question and example, and you'll appreciate that a lot of the organizations we work with don't really like us to share this data publicly. Actually, we engaged with an organization, the University of Alberta, as an international example. They were in a world where suddenly falling oil revenues meant that the government said to them, actually, our tax take is down, your funding model is broken, we're going to take 30% out of your budget. What can you do in response to that? And what they did was they actually collected the data, used the data, and generated at the end of its sustainable savings. So within 2 years, they were able to demonstrate that they put in place the savings that they needed to. So I suppose if I was to go back to kind of why did I start and say, initially I was thinking, well, I'm chatting about data, possibly I won't get that excited about it, and why am I in a world of saying I'm really frustrated about this? This is not just about what does this mean in terms of services delivered to individuals. It also goes back to the people who are working in the public sector, who are working across a range of organisations, who all too often experience organisational change which is not based on evidence. It's possible to do. We've demonstrated that you can do it and you can prove the results from it. And if you as organisations are thinking that you're going to go through not just this year of tight financial constraints, but next year and the year after and the year after, then actually my take is it's irresponsible not to have some form of data collection that's allowing you to have that granularity of data that allows you to make sensible choices and ensure that any decision you make now actually is not going to rebound in future years. And I'd like to pause then because I've clearly gone over. But thank you everyone for listening to my passion.
Great, thank you very much, Peter. A reminder for those of you watching us online, it's bit.ly/SlidoDB49, capital S, capital DB, if you're not already there. Dyn nhw dau, which is the Welsh for anonymous too, clearly is, because they say, because you took out the jokes, can you teach Gavin how?
Maybe you need a Rosanna.
Let's start in the room for the first question. Plenty to dig into there. And we've got a question just there.
Dense University. Hi. I was wondering whether your model also factors in perhaps kind of external hidden costs to, since these are kind of public institutions, right? So where a cut to a public service may be saving for the organization, but it may have external costs that then are, I mean, for example, if you cut roads, then the economy is going to suffer. So I wonder if you have any calculation also of the broader societal effect of that.
So the model that we have doesn't look into the sort of, we collect data around the activities that people undertake, and alongside of that we look at the services that they provide. I would say that, for example, something like that, which is an investment decision as to sort of, do we provide a new bypass in area X, actually there's specific economic analysis that our system wouldn't do, or a standard benchmarking system wouldn't do.
Great, thanks. Let's stay in the room. Who wants to go next?
Hi, I'm Julianne from the ICO. I'm actually a chair of governors as well, to add to the theme today. And what I was interested in is, you've got data, but how do you add that kind of context which might not come out in data? So what I'm thinking of is, when you look at ratios of staff, the school that I'm a chair of always comes out really badly within the trust that we are. And that's because we've got a lot of kids with special education needs, so you need more, higher ratios. Higher? Is that the right word? Yeah. And then also energy costs come out really badly because we've got 13 old boilers around various buildings from different ages. So it's really interesting when I see those kind of figures about how we look like we're much worse than other schools. But how do you then add that kind of extra context in? So can your models build for that as well?
So our experience of using the models, and we use our models within the university sector around within schools at this stage, our experience is that the data informs your decision making. It doesn't make the decisions for you. So actually you can look in and go, kind of, we spend 20% more than our peer group on area X, but actually that's because our strategy says we should be spending more on that area because we're choosing to invest in that area. And now, your example of boilers, you're probably not choosing to invest in your energy costs, but you don't have much of a choice around it. So there's a point which is, the data gives you more choices, but it doesn't say that, it doesn't give you the answers.
Thanks. I'm going to go online for the next one. This is from Anonymous again. How does the public sector collaborate to do this consistently? What to centralise might best require organisations working together, but this rarely happens. For example, look at public sector estate and how little coordination of use there is.
Okay. To go to the example of the public sector estate, I think there's been significant progress over the past 15 years or so with the Government Property Agency, in a world where, and I've lost sort of earlier on, we were having conversations as to the number of different regulators or other organisations that are starting to share buildings in London, or when I say starting to share buildings, the government hubs that are in a variety of different areas. So I'm not completely without hope for that. I would say it is a case where I think there needs to be a series of passionate advocates for something like this. So actually people being those people that share the frustration that I have, which is, it kind of feels, and I don't know if people have seen the episodes of The Simpsons where the chap walks out of a truck and he kind of steps on a rake and then he steps on another rake and then another rake. If you've not seen that, I'd recommend that episode. But actually, I view the same thing in terms of leaders of government and organisations and public bodies, which is every year we're being hit in the face by the same requirement to cuts, but actually the increasing the capability of the organisation to be able to adapt to what is a 5 or 10 year projection of increasing challenge budgets is not something we yet do.
Great, thank you. I'm going to stay online for the next question as well. Another anonymous asks, structuring data and building up the data set to the point that we can use it often involves translating analogue data to discrete data. How can we ensure that the quality of the data or message is not lost during this translation process?
So the approach that we've taken around this, and this has been based on kind of 15 years of development, and I think the individuals who were kind of the guinea pigs in year one probably had a much more painful experience than those in kind of year 7 and 8 and onwards, is actually what's important is to have a single coherent data collection process. It's designed in such a way that you are asking it in a limited way of people. We find that the way to collect this data is not to say, let's take analog data and let's try and sort of force it into this. It's to say, we value this data so much that around about an hour from a manager per year, a manager of a team per year, provides that clarity that you can get through. So that's the answer that we've got to that question, which is not sort of converting something. It is actually, let's start with clean data in the first place because of the value it brings.
Great, thank you. Let's come back to the room for the next question. We've got a question down here.
Hi, I'm Joanna Work from Baltic Apprenticeships. Data as an apprenticeship standard is one of the fastest growing in England, and there seems to be so many people getting data apprentices or putting their existing staff through apprenticeships, and obviously investing in the right systems and software like yours and others. So there seems to be this kind of hunger level, which is kind of interesting and I guess good, that people want to be doing better at data, that, you know, they're doing that upskilling, reskilling, bringing people in. But I'm really interested from your opinion as a global business, how do you think, you know, the UK is faring in terms of its adoption and its attitude and use compared to, you know, other countries around perhaps Europe and the world? Like, are we doing all right, or actually have we still got a long way to go?
So I would say so now operates across 5 separate countries, so I can probably speak better to that. So there are similar sort of Westminster style systems, so Canada and Australia being examples of that. What I would say is I put things into 2 categories. So I think, and I speak possibly more from a regulatory context because that's my background, I see the behaviour of regulators in the UK as being pretty innovative. So there's some good examples of Financial Conduct Authority and others who have really invested in what they know around data. So what do we hold? How can we deploy it? How can we use that to improve our role as a regulator? Where I see the UK as being a laggard is around, actually, do we understand what our organisations do? So being able to say, so for example, if we're running multiple major capital projects, do we know that the proportionate amount of time on governance is allocated to this project over here, which is worth 10 billion, versus this project over here, which is worth 1 billion, or actually is it the opposite way around? That for me is where in the UK we were behind what we could be capable of.
Thank you. You managed to avoid the phrase world leading, which is very rare when it comes to talking about the UK and the world at the moment. I've got a question from Anonymous online, which is, do you have a consistent methodology for categorising the work people do at that right level of granularity? And how do you tailor that to specific sectors, if at all? How do your categorisation choices bias the data?
So the last point on that question is probably the hardest. if I could start off with, yes, we do have a set of consistent questions around task and role. We collect it down to saying, actually, what's around, sort of, if I was asking about your role, Gavin, and I know that you operate for Gavin Freeguard Enterprises, so possibly it's a smaller organisation than most, but a kind of in buckets of around 10% of your time over the course of the year, what is it that you do? And the question is there for a manager to say, well, actually, this is what this individual does, and actually, I'm going to pick out a subset of that, and we build up that picture. And what we've found with that over time is, while there is an element of that, of it sort of blurs around the edges, it's a pixelated picture as opposed to the full picture, when it adds together, it does tell a story, and it tells a story for organisations. So we find that the data collected in year one tells a very similar story to that year two and year three, so actually the picture is in there and there. As far as the question, which is, what's the way of categorising that for different sectors? What we found in doing that, so we use our methodology, which is what we describe as Uniforum. In looking at that for public sector organisations, we've got a separate approach, which is around CiviForum, where we broadened the range of categories, because actually what's done in a higher education sector is obviously different about what's done by government departments. But actually the fundamental point, which is, can you make better decisions if you know more what your organisation does? It's pretty valid across sectors.
Brilliant. I shudder to think what you'd find out that I actually do from day to day. Peter, thank you very much indeed. Time for our third speaker now, and that's Dominic.
Thank you. First things first, you'll tell from the accent, I think the only reason I'm here is because I'm Welsh, and there's a bit of a Welsh theme going on today. I can speak a little bit of Welsh, but not enough to interpret some of those questions online.
More than I can, I think.
So I'm Dominic Hale from the Office for National Statistics, and I'm currently working on something called the Integrated Data Programme, which is looking to deliver an integrated data service for government and the wider research community as well. So you've got the kind of stat I talked about, my question around use cases earlier, you know, and some of these problems presenters have actually already covered. You know, some of the kind of the real big hitting problems with data sharing across the public sector, and there are many. You know, there may be more than this kind of 10 on the list here. Some of the things with kind of fragmented data, siloed working, you know, there are some kind of departments who work in silo. Sometimes that's fine because the data within that department might be the only data that specific department actually needs. But we need to start thinking about kind of more broadly across government what other departments might make use of that data as well. Resource availability, and one of the questions just now was around kind of skills. You know, do we have the kind of recruitment and capability within the public sector? Can it be afforded within the public sector to do what we need to do to our data to make that data more usable for the public good? Common data standards, inconsistent data quality, legacy systems. I was talking in the green room about legacy systems only just now. Big problem for government. Government spends a lot of money on legacy technology. So these are just a few of the kind of the problems that the government has when it comes to consistency and data sharing and the like. So it's a known issue. Everyone in the room kind of is aware of what I've already talked about there and broader concerns as well. These are just a few snapshots of a few publications, the CDDO leading on transforming for a digital future 22 to 25, which fell out of the National Data Strategy. Sir Patrick Vallance's Pro Innovation Technologies Review, one of the last things he did before stepping aside from his role as well. And then here on the left-hand side, cross-government working. You've seen kind of Alex Chisholm and Kat Little and others giving kind of evidence at parliamentary committee recently, and there was recommendations in a paper about government needs to work better together to share its data assets. So what are we doing as a government, as departments, to try and solve this issue? Well, the Integrated Data Service is not doing everything, clearly. We're one of a number of kind of data sharing pilots, projects and programs that are working collaboratively across departmental boundaries. But I'll focus on the Integrated Data Service, because that's what I know more about. So what is the Integrated Data Service? So what we've built, and it is there, it is live in a beta form, and it's usable, a cloud-based, what we call trusted research environment, which has been accredited to share data under the research and analysis strand of the Digital Economy Act. So this is actually a service that is in existence at the moment and has around 100 data sets on that service as well. Our strapline is bringing together kind of ready-to-use data to enable faster, wider collaborative analysis for the public good. It has to be for the public good. When we share data, we talk about kind of sharing data across departments. You know, we've got kind of commercial data within the Integrated Data Service as well. We've got kind of mobility data from telecommunications companies. And we're looking to kind of onward share that data and make it available for the user base of the Integrated Data Service as well. So these are kind of a few of the key elements for the Integrated Data Service. So moving left to right, and I've got double the amount of slides than what I've got time, and you're supposed to have 1 minute a slide, so I'll go through this quite rapidly. So technology, so like I say, it's cloud-based, in fact, multi-cloud as well. So we want to move to a model of distributed data, so we don't have to move data across government's digital estate more. We can kind of interoperability of systems and connected data. We're not there yet. In fact, we're quite far off that. At the moment, we have the classic, you know, data exchange. We'll put it in a secure, lockdown, cloud-based environment and then make it available. In future, that's what we want to actually move to. As I say, it's already accredited under the Digital Economy Act, so it's secure, scalable, everything you expect from a government-trusted research environment. I'll talk a little bit about the data linkage element in a bit. So this is kind of the top, is anybody who's shared data across government will be very familiar with this kind of data pipeline, let's call it, across the top there in orange. A new policy question appears, you've got to mobilize analytical teams, you've got to identify what data you want for the policy question, you've got to negotiate that data. That can take 3 years, the policy question's then gone. You know, so that is not a good model for government to operate in. What we're looking to do in the Integrated Data Service is more at the bottom. And this was kind of one of the questions I was asking Viv earlier around, you know, are you looking at kind of sharing data for use cases, which is kind of that top level there? Or are we looking to share data across government so when that policy question appears, the data is already there and available in standardized form so we can use it, so we don't lose critical time? Some of the benefits through different lenses here. So one of the benefits for an analyst, a researcher, is kind of a unified kind of data catalog from across government in a standardized way, which they can access for specific projects. Drawing on large scale administrative data, commercial data and the like, all in a single environment. And collaboration, really, really key. Government collaborates an awful lot kind of across departments on analysis, but also with a wider research community as well. So the Integrated Data Service will allow for kind of people in academia to collaborate with people in Department for Education, MOJ, whatever department it's actually in. And data suppliers. Like I say, data is shared a lot across government. There's a lot of duplication and a lot of friction in that process as well. For a data supplier, we want to move to a world where they share their data once, and then that data is made onwardly available through the IDS. So for example, if HMRC, I always use HMRC, so if HMRC share a data set, they might share that data set 4 or 5 times at different departments, so that's not a cost-effective model of doing things. So share that data once, lock it down securely in the Integrated Data Service, and then make that data available through a single service. That's the model that we're looking at. Which leads to kind of better policy decisions for decision makers within kind of the UK government. privacy enhancing technologies is one of the key things for us. So somebody talked about unique reference IDs earlier. So that's something that we're doing via the reference data management framework. We have kind of five core indexes: demographic, address, business, classification, and geography. We're anonymizing the data before anybody has that data, attaching unique reference numbers, which will allow an analyst to come in and draw with one line of code, draw in data from this data set and data from that data set using their unique identifier. Nobody knows who that is, because it's ABC123567. Staying on the Welsh theme, and I didn't do this on purpose, but it just so happens that one of the recent use cases was around Welsh government and actually Welsh language speakers. So the first minister's, one of the first minister's priorities for 2025 is to increase kind of Welsh, native Welsh tongue. And we were able to kind of do some analysis in this, drawing in the annual population survey, labour force survey, having those two standardised data sets so they could do the analysis they required. This is just a snapshot of where we are on the service. Recently made 43 new data sets available on the service. And you can see this is the kind of the maturity and the scale up over time. But the challenges remain. There's still a lot of challenges around data sharing. So this is one of the latest kind of publications to recommend to government that, you know, there's real change that's actually needed in this space. This was the Professor Denise Leavesy review into the UK Stats Authority, and you can see the recommendation there. One of a number of challenges and one of a number of white papers and policies that have been published in the last couple of years to say the same thing. Government need to do better with data sharing, and we hope the IVS will be not the silver bullet, but go a long way to help him with that. And that's it. Thank you very much.
Brilliant. Very much indeed.
No worries.
Again, if you're watching us online, please use the Slido. Lots of you already are. If you're not there, it's bit.ly/SlidoDB49. I'm going to start online, actually. You touched on this already, but Jeremy asks, and thank you, Jeremy, for leaving your name. Please, can you give us some examples of data sets that are available in the IDS?
Yeah, sure. So a lot. ONS, as the lead delivery partner for the Integrated Data Service, has made some of this kind of critical data assets available already. So the Census 2021 data, for example, one of the richest data sets across government, is available. There's a lot of labour markets data, a lot of survey data that the ONS collects. Like I say, there's around about 100 data sets. gov.uk/IDS, there's a data section on there, so please feel free to have a look at that.
Brilliant, thank you. Let's come into the room for the next question. We've got one right at the back.
Shemai. Diolch yn fawr. Thank you. So I'm Sam, I'm a civil servant, and just full disclosure, Dominic and I used to work together. But Dom, I was wondering if you could kind of give us a sense of how you think we can kind of tackle the cultural challenges that kind of remain to actually kind of realise this ambition.
I think, well, we all know it's a challenge, first and foremost, Sam. It's about recognising our challenge. But I think it needs to be recognised at the top table. I don't think departments can do it alone. The Office for National Statistics certainly cannot do it. The Integrated Data Service certainly cannot do it. It needs some leaning from the top, really, be it kind of ministerial, permanent secretary, whatever it is. I think that's the only way that we're going to do it, really.
Just following on from that, actually, Tom King, evening to you, Tom, notes the Leavesy review in his question and says that one of the things in there is the UKSA, the UK Statistics Authority Board, should engage more with the IDS programme. With a big project like this spanning departments, what do you really want from them to help things along?
Yeah, it's interesting because my team actually, brief into the UKSA board, which Siri and Diamond chairs. I mean, what do we need from them? I think not just that it's not unique to the UKSA board, I think it's more kind of for the senior civil servants kind of around government to advocate for the Integrated Data Service. Because, you know, you can often feel a little bit like a lone voice I come on stage, I talk about the integrated data service, and our colleagues do exactly the same things. But I think the board, and I know they're really invested and engaged in the integrated data service, because I clearly know a few of the board members. But similarly, kind of director generals of digital and data across government, you know, we need people like that on board who can make a difference.
Great, thank you. I'm going to stay online with a question from Anonymous. How will the IDS work with the federated data platform? Do you bring ONS data to FDP or health data to IDS?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, and there's no right answer to that. I mean, we're having conversations. There's people in the room from ESRC who I'm having conversations with about federated data, because what we don't want, and what we're not trying to do, is the integrated data service be, like I said earlier, that silver bullet, and all the data is migrated there. We want that interoperability. Otherwise, we're not really unleashing the benefits, are we? Because data is being shared with the IDS and it's being shared with others. In terms of kind of, you know, where that data is, if that data is already on a cloud native trusted research environment, then the IDS, sorry, I'll call it IDS, it's familiar with me, should be able to connect to it. There's no need to move it out of there into the IDS. That goes against the benefits case, really.
Great, thank you. Let's come into the audience. We've got another one in the back row. I'll come to you next time.
Hi, Sam from MedConfidential on Sam Rowe. MedConfidential runs a website at goodtreswork.com, which starts to highlight TREs that work very well. IDS is not going to be on the good list. So you talk about transparency. So why does publication of the full list of data sets and the full list of projects require a parliamentary question? And what does ONS gain from keeping it secret?
Yeah, listen, I don't think ONS IDS is keeping that a secret at all. I mean, what we have to remember is the IDS is in a beta form. It's not an officially live kind of service yet. You know, we want to get DEA accredited for data preparation so we can do the preparation of data within the IDS rather than doing it in kind of satellite platforms as well. We're trying to be as transparent as we possibly can, hence why in my presentation I said that we released kind of 43 additional data sets on the website last week. You know, we've answered kind of two or three parliamentary questions now around kind of running costs of the integrated data service, how much data do you have on there, how many projects do you have. We're being as transparent as we need to be.
Thanks. I'll go online for the next one. This is Anonymous again. Would you tell a project that they couldn't use data linked by the IDS if it was obviously toxic to public trust?
Toxic to public trust. Interesting. So, I mean, there shouldn't be data on the IDS where that becomes an issue. As I say, you know, the IDS model and the privacy enhancing technology that's built through the aforementioned reference data management framework means that all of the data are anonymized at the point of access, and therefore, if you're going to publish any of that data, I don't see there as being a risk.
Thanks. We had a question in the room just there.
Hi, my name is Daniel Smith. The question was around the data sets, whether the ambition is for them to be dynamic data sets, or are they static at the moment? So going forward, the benefit to the organisations being able to work with something more dynamic, and coming to you for the data set than to the department that created it in the first place. Yeah. Why the middleman?
Yeah, so very much dynamic. So I used an example earlier around the O2 mobility data that we acquired. So that data is going to be refreshed on, I believe, a weekly or a fortnightly basis. So what's real time, I suppose, and what is dynamic? It's very, very difficult to kind of say what that is. But yes, refreshed, time-stamped data sets rather than kind of static data sets. Clearly, if there's survey data on there and that's a quarterly survey, it's not going to refresh. But if there are kind of real-time feeds, then yes, we will do that. Are we in a position to do that right now? No. Although we're doing it with the O2 mobility data. But yes, that's what we're aiming for.
Thanks. I want to go online for the next one. This is from Bryn, brackets, not Welsh, close brackets. To what extent will the integrated data service be available to general public users, or is it aimed at accredited users only?
Yeah, so I should have said that in my presentations. So it's for accredited researchers. So you have to go through an accreditation process to actually be able to access the IDS. What that accreditation process looks like, I believe it's a reasonably light touch. I'm not kind of close to the detail on that, but yes, you, as a member of the public, you will not be able to kind of go in and access it. And at this moment in time and going into the future, you know, it's for specific use cases. You can't just go into the IDS and say, I'll pick up that data, pick up that data. There has to be some kind of governance behind it, even if it's kind of a lot lighter touch than what it is at the moment.
Great. I'm going to squeeze in a quick final question from Jeremy. Prioritise data sharing, quote unquote. With the abundance of data available, how do we prioritise what data to share?
Yeah, so the Central Digital and Data Office are working in this space at the moment. They run an initiative called Essential Shared Data Assets, ESDA, because we love an acronym in government. So they're working across the departments to identify key data that are shared multiple times across government. And the ONS has, you know, supplied a list of all its essential shared data assets and already made them available on the IDS, and we're hoping that other departments will follow suit. So it's kind of based on the prioritisation is very much based at the moment on, you know, how often that data is currently being shared across government, so we can remove that friction.
Great. Well, Dominic, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
And that brings us to our fourth and final speaker this evening, and that's Steve. We're switching to a different laptop. Very exciting.
Hello. Well, thank you very much to the IFG and to Highways for inviting me to come and talk to you this evening. Great pleasure to be here. Before I say anything, I just want to give a big shout out to one Gerge Rikuya, who is the product owner for this at Highways, but is on paternity leave at the minute. Otherwise, he would be here. He has been absolutely pivotal to everything I'm going to show you this evening. So massive thanks to Gerge. And having said that, does this look familiar to anyone? So I've spent most of my career in various forms of organizational transformation, as it is so called, and I've maybe become a little bit too cynical about it, but I don't know, transformation seems to have become almost like a steady state that's just always going on in the background, but nothing actually seems to genuinely transform. Maybe a few incremental benefits here and there, a few efficiency gains, but it's just sort of background noise, and it's almost like the more you keep trying to change things, the more they seem to stay the same. And if you identify with that experience, I want to suggest one reason possibly why that is happening, amongst many reasons I'm sure that you could give. But it's one that I think is hidden for various reasons I'm going to explain. And in order to demonstrate it, I'm not going to try and give you lots of words. We're going to play a game. Sounds like you guys are quite a technically savvy audience, so you're going to get this. It's a game of complete the diagram. So here is a diagram with some words on it, and your job is to figure out what the bottom of the diagram looks like. I'm going to give you a few seconds to look at it and just think in your head, what do you think the bottom of the diagram is? Hopefully you figured this out. We've got capability of a server, cloud, some seats. The answer is obviously Serena Williams. Did everyone get that? No? No. Yeah? You. Occasionally you get some completely random answers involving different combinations of clouds and servers and things, but that experience you have when you think language means one thing and then the world takes a side swipe is a very common one in my experience, maybe like a year, 18 months into a big major transformation program where you realize that this project team over here actually thought what you meant in the killer slide that started the whole thing off is completely different to what the original sponsor thought, who's probably now left, and it's certainly different to what this project team over there thought. And the reason I think this happens is because we don't pay enough attention to the extent to which the meaning of what we're doing is buried inside all of the tribal identity that people who come to project teams have. Because it's just much, much more socially comfortable to assume that because we're all using the same words, which you probably are, we all mean the same thing. And to me, it's a little bit like this. Language is like the water that fish swim in. It's like the air that we breathe. And when you come to a problem from a particular perspective, maybe you're, I don't know, this is you, you're data architects on the left-hand side. So when you read any of these words, you have your data architecture hat on. But then you talk to somebody in, I don't know, marketing. Like, take the word service. If you're an architect, service has a particular definition, which is encoded in standards and your whole history of professional development. What is that to somebody in marketing? It's probably all about customers and interaction and so on. And this doesn't get noticed. And the reason I think this is so critical for data professionals is, I think this is starting to change a bit now, but historically, my observation is that data professionals have this tendency to assume that the data can be treated as some kind of neutral commodity. And they tend to be more comfortable, again, I'm tarring everybody with the same brush, and I think the situation is changing, with dealing with the bottom half of this. Let's just treat the data as something that we can figure out how to join it together, and then we'll come up with the answer. And you cannot separate it from the context in which it has been formed. And that's on multiple levels. So the data that exists here in these tables, the meaning of that data is buried in the schemas of the tables, of the data sets, which come from a particular software system, which is sold by a particular vendor, which was coded maybe like 15, 20 years ago, which has been sold by account managers and enterprise software systems into a bubble, into a tribe, because that's finance software. It has to do finance things. This is marketing software, or it's architecture software. Now, when you multiply that across thousands of tribes, all needing their own identities across a large organization or whole ecosystem, it's just really, 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 really complex. So we've been working on a program that tries to identify this, to address what we call the shared meaning problem. The meaning is much more fragmented than we like to believe than it is. And we've built a platform at Highways which starts to pull together where we know we've got shared meaning so we can start building on those shared identities. So I want to share a few principles of how we've done that, and then I'll show you a little tour of the platform so you get an idea of what it looks like. First thing we've done is to decouple the data from the applications, which is what I've just been talking about. I'll not go into all of the technical aspects of that. Highly recommend this book on the right, if anyone is familiar with Dave McComb's work and the idea of data centricity, moving away from an application-centric way of doing things. That's quite a difficult thing to do for all the reasons that I've just said, because the meaning of the data is so tied into the schemas. But if you can find a way through conversation, that's the first thing, talk to people. Talking to people is really good. To find out what they mean by the data that they have in their spreadsheets, in their Access VBA models and their collection of various bits of enterprise software. If you can find out how to connect those things back to things that exist in the world, and then you can find some way to connect those things together, which is what knowledge graphs do. So we've built an RDF graph. We can talk about the technology later if anyone's interested in that. What you can then do, and this is the clever thing of what we've done, is you can start to reconnect all that data back to shared visual representations that make more sense to the people who own that data. And finally, in order to make any of this work, you have to establish feedback loops. So this sounds a little bit like a technology solution to a people problem. It's really not. If anything, it's the other way around. And this doesn't work unless you have people at the heart of it. You need to create easy ways for people to feedback that this data is wrong. That needs to go to the person who owns the data. You need some form of mediating intermediary group, which we call an editorial network, which then has eyes on the whole thing to see whether clusters of feedback actually suggest the whole model is wrong. Okay, that's me talking very quickly because I've only got 8 minutes. That gives me about 90 seconds to demonstrate what this actually looks like in practice. So what we've built is we've taken a knowledge graph, but instead of presenting it as a knowledge graph and expecting you to learn graph-based ways of querying the data, we've actually hidden it inside an adapted GIS model. So this is using an open source GIS framework, which works just like Google Maps, so people are familiar with it. So I can zoom in and out of this. And back to Peter's point before, that nobody actually knows how these organizations work, right? That's the fundamental problem. How do you change something you don't actually know what it is? So this is an activity model of highways, and if I zoom in, I get more and more detail about what the activities are that people do. This is not just an organizational structure, this is the patterns of how the organization works as a system that endure from one reorganization to another. And if you keep zooming in, you just get more and more in detail. You can get, you know, to whatever level of detail you want, but the thing is, it's actually a graph. So if I click on any of these things, I'll find that it's actually a node in a graph. And I can start to apply information. I should say all of the names in here and so on have been anonymized. And bonus points if anyone can figure out how we've done that, because there is a pattern to it. Which means I can see, like, this activity is performed by a particular group of people. And there they are. It's led by this person who is anonymized, who holds this position. And what you can see is it shows you where that data has come from, because we've extracted it out of the various APIs from all of the source systems. What we can then do is we can see, well, where is that person? So we've got multiple maps here. And this person, because it's a person, will also appear on an organization map. And this is a computationally generated tree map from all of the Oracle data of the breakdown of the whole organizational structure. And the beauty of it is, at any point, just like Google Maps, you zoom out and you see the Earth. So you've got a shared context of what we're all trying to do, is I can zoom out and get the shared context of the whole organization. So that's all of the people who work there. That's all of the activities. And if you keep zooming out, that's what we're there to do. So you can have the purpose, the top level view, zoom into whatever you're interested in. And as you can see, sorry, I need to stop, don't I? I just love playing with this. It's a lot of fun. The more data sets you put in, the more interesting it becomes, because, like, literally, I can just type in the name of whoever I meet in the meeting, or if they say a concept I'm not familiar with, I just type it in, and it shows me all the things that we know about that person or that team or whatever it is. Okay, I better stop. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Steve. It's one of those tag yourself, I'm rancorous carp sort of scenarios, I think. Yeah. If you're watching us online, please use Slido to put your questions to Steve. It's bit.ly/SlidoDB49 if you're not already there. Let's start in the room. Plenty to dig into there. Who wants to go first? We'll come down to you first, and then we'll come to...
That looks beautiful, by the way. You know, and I guess so user-friendly to be able to have it visualised like that. And, you know, when you think of every person on the street or, you know, within kind of organisations, public sector organisations, to be able to make something so user-friendly like that, how long does it take to get from, I guess, the chaos, which is what was started with, to get something like that?
So actually, the prototype probably took about 6 months, I would say. This program, so we're getting a system into production. The public sector turns out to be quite an involved process, so it's taken a bit of time. This went into production in September, October, and it's been, I mean, we probably first started talking about this maybe a couple of years before that. There's been so many conversations. I mean, it really does come down to building relationships and understanding with people, which just does take time. The actual technology, really not that complicated. Some basic ETL pipelines, some transforms to turn the tables into RDF. It's all about the conversations you're having with people to figure out what actually are the classes of things. And the basic principle here is, and this is, for me, like the foundational principle for building shared meaning with anything is, if I want to build shared meaning with you, or with you, or with any community of people, the quickest way to do that is to find a way to connect the symbols that we use, whether it's words or pictures, to some kind of shared experience that we have of being in the world. And you can only really do that by talking to people and watching them and finding out, like, what is the context in which you're... Because, like, nothing in there is particularly complex. Like, if you look at the classes, I've got people, I've got teams, I've got some of the financial concepts, cost centers, you've got suppliers, you've got contracts. Like, there's nothing particularly complicated in there.
Thanks.
Can you tell what the usage is if you've been in place since the autumn? How what's the uptake been?
The uptake. So we're treating this almost like a Wikipedia type approach of being bottom up. So we haven't done any like big launches. We're slowly moving around from directorate to directorate, because as we say, that feedback loop is the crucial thing in the middle. People need to say, we're opting into this to put our data in, please add it to the graph and so on. But it's been, modestly spectacular since we started with just in the couple of directorates that we've done it, is that when people have found this thing, particularly as you'd expect, contractors, as soon as you come onto a consulting assignment and you're given, if you can get a B2B account, you get access to this and you find it, and suddenly, how much time am I saving, or even better, how much time am I not wasting of stakeholder time asking the same questions, figuring out who do I talk to about this, understanding who are these people in this meeting I'm with, because I can just find out straight away because it's all in one place. So we've now got several hundred regular users who just found this thing.
Thanks. I'm going to go online for two questions next. So your National Highways colleague and Databytes veteran, Adam Locker. Evening to you, Adam.
Hi, Adam.
Organisations have multitudinous and incredibly detailed methods and standards for documenting their own processes, technology and finances. Why do you think they don't exhibit the same rigour about documenting their own organisations?
That's a good question. So, they can answer that question so many. Adam's really good at questions. There's so many ways of answering that. So one thing is, what actually is an organization? What actually is it? Is it like the terms of reference under which it exists, like pieces of paper, contractual talk? Like, is it that? Is it the people who work there? Is it the processes? Is it the? It's actually quite hard to nail exactly what it is. I think when you push people, most people will say, it's the org tree, it's the org structural diagram. And the trouble with that is that that changes all the time, right? The thing underneath it of what people do, when you stay for long enough, realize that it doesn't actually change very much at all. Some of the tools that people use change, what they call processes change, the people who run that team change, and so on. But you have to be there for quite a long time to realize that that hasn't changed. To me, that's the essence of the organization, is this recurring pattern of activities. But I think we look at it in the wrong place. If we look at it as just a series of processes, or it's an org chart or whatever. There's a much more technical answer I could give to that, around how the activity model is structured as a nested set of recursive elements. But it's 3 minutes, sorry.
Thanks. The next question is from Joanna, who says, finally, a chance to use my philosophy degree. Any thoughts on Wittgenstein, who argues that we were misled by the uniform appearance of our words, especially when we are doing philosophy, brackets, or rather doing organisational transformation, close brackets.
Right, okay. Ask a question about Wittgenstein and put organisational transformation in brackets in the end, and it's all good. Wittgenstein, and again, it's a similar thing where I think that statement is fundamentally true, that we do misconstrue what language is. And the best analogy I can come up with is that metaphor. I use that picture a lot of the two fish in the bowls, is that we don't notice language most of the time until it breaks down. To stick with the philosophical theme. So Heidegger has this concept of breakdown that he uses, that you don't notice the tools that you use in life most of the time until something goes wrong with them. You don't notice the door that you use to get in and out. You don't notice digital tools when they work. It's only when the thing comes up and I need it now and it says you have to update your app. And you're like, and otherwise you might not even notice the app. And language is like that. I think the problem is, in a project team, you often don't notice this because the other team's using jargon you don't recognize. So it's obvious, I'm a non-technical person, this person's more technical. I need to ask them what they mean. The subtlety is that when you get sufficiently senior in organizations, all the jargon's the same. Right? Everyone's talking about capabilities and digital, what is a digital transformation? As far as I can tell, digital transformation is basically the business trying to get the IT budget back, if I'm being, again, very, very cynical about it. What's the digital bit? What's the all transformations seem to be digital now. What do we actually mean by the words? And actually, I'm going to get very, very cynical now, but we're all friends here. To what extent is the language that we use more about trying to find collective identity with whoever it is that we're in the room with? So if I'm in a room with strangers, it's quite nice if I get the sense that, yeah, we're all comfortable here because we can all use this jargon in a way that makes us all sort of smile. And, you know, let's talk about improving capabilities and the pillars of our strategy and how we're going to do service-based transformation. And then all the jargon starts to flow and then everyone's flowing with it. And actually, we all go away happy and go back to our teams. Nothing's actually going to change because those words are so far removed from the reality, our shared reality that we live in.
Time for a quick final question from the room. Or I've got one online. John E. Says, are you planning to extend it to address the different meanings of the concepts or ontology used in each part of the organisation?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So one of the beautiful things about RDF is that it's super easy to alias things. So this concept is called this by these people, it's called this by these people, but the way RDF works is just a series of triples. You take all of the tables, you break all of those tables apart, you put them into a graph, and then anything that, and all those elements have unique identifiers. So if I say anything about this thing, it's got a unique identifier. I know that you're talking about the same thing that I'm talking about. So you can call it this, I can call it that, but it has the same unique identifier, so we all know it's the same thing.
Well, Steve, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
I think Wittgenstein and Heidegger in the same answer might be a data bytes first, even after 49 events. A few quick parish notices before I let all of you in the room go to the reception afterwards, and those of you online log off for the evening. We will aim to have video of this event up on the IFG website in 24 hours, and audio as well. You'll already be able to watch it back as live on Slido or YouTube. You probably know what the Slido is by now. Lots of other IFG events coming up over the next few weeks. We have the next event is tomorrow lunchtime, How Can Government Tackle Fraud, where speakers include Emily Thornberry, the Shadow Attorney General. We've also got events coming up on the Treasury, public sector strikes, AI and electoral disinformation, the Lord Speaker, polling in the general election and London and devolution. As I said, do keep an eye on the IFG website for the date of the next Data Bytes, or make sure that you sign up for our events email. If you would like to sponsor a future one, including the 50th event, or if you'd like to speak, please do get in touch with myself or with Pritesh or with another member of the IFG team. All that remains for me to say are three very big thank yous. First of all, to you, the audience here in the room and online. Some brilliant questions today. A huge thank you to Naus Group, without whom this event simply would not have been possible. So a very big thank you to you. And please do join me in a very big thank you as well for our four brilliant speakers this evening. Diolch yn fawr iawn.